This is Writer's Voice, airing on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Just a few weeks in, she was asked to take part in interrogations of prisoners and allegedly witnessed with severe techniques, maybe what we might call torture. And she asked out. She said, I don't really want to do this. I don't want to take part in this. And she apparently was so troubled by her experience that just a few days after, she committed suicide.
That's Greg Mitchell. We talked to him in the second half of the show about his book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. In the first half of the show, we'll talk about a great new novel with author Rabi Alameddine. It's called The Hakawati. Until TV and radio took over, the Hakawati, or storyteller, was a major figure in the culture of Arabic-speaking countries. Typically, the Hakawati would station himself at evening time in a cafe or in a nice spot in the open air. There he would recite episodes from some of the great sagas of Arab lore for his rapt audiences. His new novel, The Hakawati, spins many tales into a wondrous tapestry. Some are fables, some sagas of the medieval era, but the central story is about a grandfather and his grandson in modern Beirut. The old man is a Hakawati, one of the last of the breed. His grandson tells his story, and through it, the story of Lebanon itself. Rabi Alameddine, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, The Hakawati, tell us what a Hakawati is.
A Hakawati is basically a storyteller. Now, in the olden days, they were more professional, as in they would go to a cafe and they get paid basically on how good the story was. So they could extend a story for about a month, 2 months, sometimes even 6 months. And they get paid per night. They get fed. The Hakawatis are also used to go from village to village and tell stories. Same thing. They'd get fed for the night. They get, you know, put up for the night. If somebody gets good, then he moves up and he becomes a Hakawati for an important person. And then that gets riskier because if they don't entertain well, something drastic might happen to them. Well, a Hakawati these days is just somebody who tells a good story, a storyteller. It could also be somebody who tells good gossip or somebody who could tell a tall tale. It's just, basically now it means a storyteller.
Are there still professional Hakawatis?
Not that much, you know. You would probably have to go to some of the small towns. Like I hear there's some really good Hakawatis still in villages in northern Syria, but they're Kurds. They're basically a dying breed now.
But there does seem to be a special role of poetry and literature in Arab culture, I mean, even surviving to today. Is that true?
Yes, it's still, right now, even literature is still about telling a great tale. Almost all of the poetry was about sort of narrative poetry. So yes, it's still part of the tradition. I mean, they've influenced Arabic literature quite a bit.
Now, you tell many wonderful stories that really weave in and out of the narrative like a kind of tapestry. Mm-hmm. But it seems that there are three main stories in this book.
Right.
Tell us about those stories.
Well, the first story would be probably the contemporary story and the family story. So it is what holds the book together is the contemporary narrator going back to Beirut after living for years abroad and then finding out that his father is at the hospital and the vigil that takes place. So within that, we're told three different strands. One is the story of the family itself and how it started and all the various strands from that. Then there's the story of Fatima, who is basically goes into the underworld, and that tale tends to be more magical and more fantastic. And that's based on a number of various myths, both Western and Arabic. And then there's the story of Baybars, and Baybars was the sultan. Now, his story is he was a real historical figure, but the stories that are told about him are completely fictional. But he is one of the traditional stories of the Hakawatis. So this is a purely a traditional story that I took, and now I changed it almost. It becomes unrecognizable almost, but it is one of the traditional ones, and I wanted one traditional Hakawati story in the book.
And that's really an epic tale.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's been told for, you know, since Baybars existed, which I believe was 1200-something.
Well, maybe we could start there. Say something about who he was, and then how did you change the story?
Who he was is he was a sultan. He was actually a Mamluk, and the Mamluks ruled Egypt and a lot of the Arab world for about 250 years. They came to power. They were slaves brought in to basically protect the empire, and they became so organized, and they began to rule. They were the sultans. At the time, the Arab world then was conquered by almost all the coast was under the reign of the Crusaders, and they were also conquered by the Mongols. And under his reign were the first defeat of the Mongols. And under his reign, he was also able to kick out most of the Crusaders. So he was an important figure. Now, the story that was told, in the book I say that the story of Baybars is actually more interesting than the story of Baybars, which is that he basically, to make himself popular, started paying Hakawatis to tell his tale. And that's why there is this tradition of telling the Baybars tale, because it's been going on for so long, because he basically wanted that. He was, in many ways, a precursor of a lot of presidents we have today.
You say he was a great publicist.
That's basically what it was. It was basically a president who knew how important publicity was. He was way ahead of his time.
And he wasn't such a nice guy, was he?
No, he wasn't. Well, you know, I mean, is there any ruler who's a nice guy? You know, but what was truly great was that the story began to develop, and since he was a, you know, sultan, for the general public, they began to introduce characters that were more sort of that the general public can identify with, and so you get these minor characters that began to take over the story. And how I changed that was, of course, my story of Baybars has little to do with Baybars, but it really doesn't. It has to do much more with the minor characters. And where I took off completely is by introducing, say, the wife of his stable boy, who basically became the heroine of the tale.
Right. In fact, women play a fairly prominent role in your tale in general,
yeah.
Even in the contemporary one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's important because partly it... what started out as my narrator grows up in a family with very strong women. So, of course, when he's going to tell these tales, the women begin to take over, sort of like in his life. So, yeah, that's where one of the major differences between my tale of Baybars and the main narration of the novel.
Now, your narrator, you said, it's hard to tell always who the narrator really is.
Exactly, which is, we can call it sort of a meta-narrator. There are many Hakawatis in the book, and each tell their own stories. And even the minor characters tell stories. And then sometimes within the story itself, you know, like when Fatima goes down to the underworld and she meets Afit Jahannam, which is sort of somewhat of a demon, maybe, you know, the devil. Then he begins to tell her stories, and I love that. It's basically stories within stories. Who's the main narrator is probably Osama, but it's never sure.
And we're talking about The Hakawati, Arabic for storyteller. It's a new novel by my guest, Rabi Alameddine. Tell us a bit about Osama and his family.
Well, Osama is the narrator, is the main character. I mean, around him, the story revolves. His grandfather sort of begins the tale because he was the founder of the family, so to speak. And he came down from Turkey because of many reasons, he had to escape sort of what was to become the Armenian genocide. And he comes to Lebanon and gets adopted by this sort of political figure. And he becomes his Hakoweti and begins a family. And he is a little bit, he has a strange character, but he tells all these stories and he bewitches the narrator, Osama. But then when the war starts, Osama leaves the country and then comes back to be at his father's bedside and sort of gets reintegrated into the family.
Now, the grandfathers in the book, the grandfather in the book, he was one of the more compelling characters, of many compelling characters, but at mm-hmm. least among the real family in the book, mm-hmm. or the contemporary family. And he comes from a very mixed background. His father was an English doctor, his mother an Armenian maid,
mm-hmm.
and Lebanon itself, it seems that there are many, many, it's like a melting pot.
Right, it is. And that's what I wanted to talk about in the book. This is my response in some ways to the World Trade Center bombings and how we view Arabs these days. Everybody sees the Arab world as this homogeneous entity, and it actually isn't. Even within Lebanon, which is a very, very small country, it really is a melting pot of many different peoples, many different religions, so that it's not just one thing, and that's what makes it both exciting, and that's what also makes it so troubling, is that, you know, it is not one nation of people, it is not one homogeneous thing.
Did you come from a Druze family also?
Yes, yes. I came from a Druze family, and I'm actually less, I'm sort of pure Druze, in that both my mother and my father were Druze from a certain class of Druze. So I'm not as mixed as Osama is.
I'll bet a lot of our listeners don't know who the Druze are, so tell us.
The Druze, we're a weird, weird sect. We're a minority within a minority. There's probably like 400,000 of us in around the world. We only really exist in Lebanon, Syria, and Israel. We were sort of an offshoot of Islam, an offshoot of Shiites, of Ismailis, that we went so far afield, I guess, that they were considered heretics by most. So we're no longer really Muslims, we're not Christians. Of course, it was one of those things where somebody decided to unify all the religions, and instead of unifying them, they made everybody hate them. it's a strange religion that I actually like, as much as I don't consider myself a believer, because they believe in reincarnation, for example, which is not something that anybody in the area does. So they included a lot of Hindu philosophy, a lot of Greek philosophy, and they don't have clerics or priests. They don't have churches or mosques. It's just a one-to-one relationship with the divine, sort of.
And it, how old is it?
I think 1360 was the birth, so about 700 years.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rabi Alameddin about his new novel, The Hakoweti. The story, the fantastic story in the book, this character Fatima, who you've mentioned, tell us a little bit about this story, and this is also kind of a story within a story within a story.
Right. Well, Fatima's story is a story that I've played around in my head for years, almost 20 years. The beginning of it was, of course, inspired by an old Babylonian myth that gets repeated again and again, which is the descent into the underworld. The old Babylonian myth has the goddess Inanna coming in, going down to the underworld, and through each gate she gets undressed and then dies in the underworld and is brought back to life. The Greeks had Persephone and Demeter. So that was the basis of that. Where I took it was a whole attempt as to confuse what we consider light and what we consider dark, what we consider good and evil. So it's a play on that, and it's, in my opinion, the funnest part of the book, which is it's just meant to be funny.
And she uh, We first meet her as she goes out to find a cure for barrenness. She is a slave.
Well, not a cure for barrenness, no, because the emir that she works for had 12 girls. She goes out to find a cure so that he could have with his wife a boy. And that sort of mirrors what happens with the family story, because basically the boy in the family story goes back home to see his father, and his father is dying. So it starts with, you know, father wanting a son and son wanting a father.
Ultimately, she comes back with a kind of cure, and she gives birth at the same time as her
mistress.
Her nominal mistress gives birth, and they give birth to these demon children.
Yes. Well, the twins of light and dark. I don't know if I'd call them demon children, sort of special children.
Very special children.
Very, very special.
Well, yeah, say something about what that part of the story is about, because they maybe look like light and dark, but they're quite twinned, and they seem maybe a little bit closer to the dark in their character than to the light.
I'm not sure. I mean, the thing for me, what I loved about and why I created that story is that they're actually one in the same. They reflect each other, the light and dark. One is the most beautiful, one is terribly ugly, one is, you know, very white, the other is very dark. And, you know, so like one is the sun child, and he's called Shams, and the other is, you know, the dark child, and he's called Layl, which is, you know, sun and night in Arabic. But it refers to a lot of other stories. There's a very famous Hakawati story, which is it's called the Majnun and Layla. And Majnun and Layla is about a story of this boy who falls in love with a girl and he can't have her. This is an old story. Of course, it gets repeated throughout, you know, it's the same Romeo and Juliet story. But it's also Eric Clapton sang his song Layla about that. So what I did was change it a little bit and make it Majnun and Layl. And I had it become, you know, that part of yourself, since they're basically the same child, one loses oneself and then begins a search for it. So it's basically about finding oneself within the world and finding oneself within the family.
So these archetypal stories within, I'd say quite a modern twist to them in terms of the narrative, not in terms of the history.
But also, what I wanted were stories that sort of reflect. I am, as much as I am a storyteller, I'm a novelist. What I wanted was stories that add to the novel, as in it sort of explains what's going on within the actual main part of the novel, which is the story of this family. So that these, you know, the boys and looking for themselves are reflected within what is going to happen to the narrator when his father dies. Is he part of the family? Is he not part of the family? So that all that sort of reflects back on the main novel.
Yeah, and actually you'll have, on the same page, you'll have a few paragraphs of one story and then come back to the other story.
Yeah, yes, hopefully by the end and in the last chapters, they begin to sort of wind down and then wind together.
There's another theme in this book, I guess I would say, a kind of hidden theme, and that is of homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
The two children of Fatima fall in love with each other, a clearly open sexual love. Throughout the book, there are different elements of that. But in the family story itself, it's mostly hidden. It's more by inference than anything else that the character Osama, I would assume, is homosexual, because there's only one place in the book where you talk about this crazy family. I believe it's on page 224. There are the two great-grandfathers who actually come over to the Middle East on the same boat from England, and he says they had countless things in common, and the conversation would not lag until finally, "Ah, sir, what do you say we blend the seed of my loins with your seed and produce some exasperatingly strange characters?"
Mm-hmm.
The wicked hag of the mountains, the naive and haughty villager, the mm-hmm. parsimonious simpleton, the talented, frustrated homosexual. And that's the only mention that's made.
Oh, there are other mentions. That they're talking about the uncle, whose uncle she had, who is sort of an open homosexual who because of the time and place, was not talked about. I mean, he died in 1976 or 78, I believe. He is mentioned again as being homosexual by the mother, where, you know, they have a story that he and the mother fell in love, and the mother says, oh, no, it was never falling in love because he had special relationships with women, as I call it. So she talks about his sexuality.
Well, even that is pretty vague.
Well, you have to consider the time. He existed from 1930 to 1978 or so. So it wouldn't have been talked about openly. He is, though. I mean, from his behavior and what he likes and stuff, sort of openly homosexual. The narrator, I left it vague for many reasons. I did not want him to be in a relationship because I wanted him to, I wanted the book to reflect where he was with the family. So is it a theme of, yes, it is, as to sexuality is a big part of the book. It definitely is gay and it definitely is straight, and it is talked about, but it's not talked about directly. When I wrote Kool-Aids, which was, more contemporary, the earlier novel, it's talked about openly.
And I'm speaking with Rabi Alameddine about his book, The Hakawati, his new novel. I was looking at another interview with you, and you said you felt that one of the characters in one of your previous books said, in America I fit, but I don't belong. In Lebanon, I belong, but I don't fit. And yeah. I wondered if this was some of the theme that is being touched upon in your book, The Hakawati.
Yes, of course. That sentence, or sort of two sentences, is a theme in all my books. It gets repeated over and over and over. It is one of the things that I find fascinating about life, and whether one is an immigrant or not, as to whether how people fit and how people, where people belong. I'm actually one of those that believe that most writers do not fit anywhere. I mean, they pretend to fit in certain places, but they're always on the outside looking in a little bit. So that even, whether I had stayed in Lebanon or left, or whether, I am an American, it's the idea of what part, where do I fit? And it's a constant struggle, and my characters always have that, both because they, whether they're gay or not. It has to do mostly with being an outsider. And to be able to write or to be able to actually see something clearly, you have to belong, and you have to be a little bit on the outside as well, because if you're too far outside, you can't write about, what you're looking at. But if you're too enmeshed inside, you can't write what you're looking at. You can't see it. So it's sort of this balance of fitting and not belonging, and belonging and not fitting.
Now, there's another aspect of the story that has some very real connection to what's going on today, unfortunately, and that is the war in Lebanon. The long 12 or 13-year war that happened in Lebanon is very... much of the action does take place during that time. Were you there during the war?
Not all the time. I've lived in the U.S. since 1977, but I spent about 3 months to 4 months of the year in Beirut. So while the war was going on, I was still visiting, but I did not live there directly. And actually, some characters in the book talk about that. That you are part of it, but any time I wanted to leave, I actually did.
You had a privileged position.
It's a privileged position. It makes it very different from the rest of my family, who actually are still there, and they went through the entire war.
Could you talk about the impact of the war on your work as a writer?
It's a difficult discussion, because, first of all, it's a long discussion, and it's never very clear. It's partly... the most important thing about writing when you come from a culture of war where, you know, everything could disappear in a second, is the immediacy of the writing. As much as I can be ambiguous, some things are important that have to be said and should be said.
Like what?
Like, you know, my feelings about the war. Sometimes, you know, especially, say, in my early books, I tended to be a little bit more confrontational because it needed to be said. Literature is no longer about... It feels that it has... It's more important. It feels that something must be done. It's about a response of some kind. And that was one part. The other part is for me, is humor. You know, there's a sort of gallows humor that I've picked up, and because you never know. I mean, of all the stories of war, most of what remains are the humor of it as well. It's like everything becomes a good story of the war, and most of the time a funny story of the war. So that was something I picked up. And then, you know, possibly also the fragmentation of it. That how could you sit and tell a long novel in sequence when everything that's around you is completely crazy?
And you said humor. This is also, there's a lot of marvelous satire in the book, especially mm-hmm. especially about people in authority, and also particularly about, you know, everybody comes in for the acerbic eye, including the militiamen.
Yes. No, and it's funny because this interview, I mean, I'm talking and it gets sometimes a little too serious, but, you know, sometimes I just want to go, yes, but in the book, I have lesbian mosquitoes, you know, yes, in the book, you know, the character of Arbusto, who creates all the havoc in the empire, is Portuguese, and his name is Arbusto, which means bush in Portuguese, you know. So there's all these, you know, little fun and games that are just, you know, funny and light that I, you know, rarely get to talk about unless, you know, you read the book. What I wanted, I mean, I worked on it for 8 years, and I can't work on something, you know, for like a month if it's not entertaining me and making me laugh. So that I wanted something that's both serious, that has a serious message, but that is actually a lot of fun to read.
Oh, and it is.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice, Rabih Alameddine.
Thank you for having me.
Rabih Alameddine is also the author of Kool-Aids, The Perv, and I, the Divine. He lives in San Francisco and Beirut. And if you go to writersvoice.net, you'll find a link to a 2005 NPR report on Hakawatis and the effort to preserve their tradition. It's by broadcast journalist Carrie Giardino. Next up, we talk with Greg Mitchell about So Wrong for So Long. It's about how the press promoted the war in Iraq. Stay with us. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. My next guest is Greg Mitchell. From his unique perch as editor of the trade journal Editor and Publisher, Mitchell has been able to keep a close eye on what the press and pundits say about Iraq and how they help the Bush administration sell that war to the public. He's collected his commentaries on that subject, dating from the run-up to the war in 2003 through the surge of 2007. They're all put together in a new book that provides a kind of diary of his observations of the press over the past 5 years. It's called So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. I spoke to him a few weeks ago. Greg Mitchell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Your book, So Wrong for So Long, there were moments in it where I really didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
Well, I don't know whether that's good or bad, but I'm glad it got some reaction.
Yeah. In fact, I'd like to read a quote from New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, just to start off with the humor, perhaps. On May 4th in, 2003, just a few months after the Iraq War started, that's when George Bush made his mission accomplished speech when he lighted on the aircraft carrier. The tail hook caught the last cable, jerking the fighter from 150 miles per hour to zero in 2 seconds. outbound to the cocky, rule-breaking, daredevil flyboy, a man navigating the highway to the danger zone, out along the edges where he was born to be. The further on the edge, the hotter the intensity. I wonder if you could make a comment on that and what that showed about where Dowd and other columnists and other newspaper people were at the time.
Right. Well, I recently reflected on this because we had the fifth anniversary of Mission Accomplished recently, and so I did go back and revisit some of the quotes in the book. The chapter about it in the book quotes a number of people, and Chris Matthews and Brian Williams and all sorts of mainstream people who were painting President Bush as a sort of macho, using words like hero. Chris Matthews talking about how women love him because he's a hero, and women love the macho and everything else. So there were all these people kind of falling down and gasping about the whole thing. And of course, as we know, more than 5 years later, the mission was not accomplished, and so when you do read some of these quotes and others, many others in the book, you wince. I don't know, you may laugh or you may cry, but you at least wince, and you sort of see that the estimates and statements made by so many of the officials and so many people in the press have proven so wrong, and I guess that's why I called it so wrong for so long, because it is... it has gone on for so many years now.
So you are editor and publisher. First, say something about this magazine, this journal, and also how did your perch there give you the perspective from which the book is written?
Well, editor and publisher is one of the oldest magazines in the country. It's been around for almost 125 years. It's sort of always been the Bible of the newspaper industry, trade magazine, business magazine, as it's usually described, venerable publication, certainly. And I became editor 6 years ago, and it just happened to be just before, really, the run-up to the war. So I've sort of had this ringside seat. At the same time, our website became very popular and very influential. And so I just wrote regular columns and also more newsy articles every week or sometimes every day, starting with the run-up to the war and right up to this this week that we're speaking. After a couple of years, I thought I had a tremendous amount of material for a book that could collect some of my writing and expand on some of the writing. And when I've done eight books previously with a major publisher, so I'd have track record for 20 years as a fairly successful author, and yet publishing houses editors kept saying, well, it's a good idea for now, but by the time we come out with the book, the war is going to be over, the troops are going to be coming home, and so forth. This was 3 or 4 years ago, so another couple years passed, we were still there, and so this time we're more publishers interested of maybe recognizing that we're going to be there for a long time yet, and so a book would not really go out of date. So, basically I went back over the hundreds of stories and columns and looked at the pieces that stood up today that you could learn from today, and connected all of them. There's a great deal of original material in the book besides the columns. I connect all the columns. I give background. It's a running chronology. It's really the first five-year history of the war. It didn't really set out that way, but it became that. So it really covers 5 years up to almost the present day. And it's it goes month by month. There's sort of a month-by-month chronology. Plus, I have a long introduction. Plus, there's a foreword by Joe Galloway, the famed war reporter. And there's even a preface by Bruce Springsteen.
It's the history of the war from the perspective of the reporting on it. And I guess I want to ask you is, if everybody else got it so wrong for so long, or almost everybody else, how were you able to get it so right so early?
Well, I don't know. I was taught back in journalism school, 100 years ago, that the first rule for reporting should be skeptical. That doesn't mean be critical. It doesn't mean be negative, but be skeptical. And, of course, they were talking more about most reporters who cover local government or some city scandal or something. But it applies just as well, or either maybe should apply more so, for national security affairs, reporting out of Washington, reporting on important matters of state. And it seemed like some of the best reporters in the country dropped that first rule and were not skeptical enough, and so kind of fell for the propaganda and the statements from the administration, which have proven to be so bogus. So I just felt I was looking at the material that was coming out, or the evidence, and was suspicious of some of these characters anyway, given their track record, and it just didn't seem to add up to me as worth a preemptive war. And being old enough to remember the Vietnam era, and knowing that while Iraq is not Vietnam, there are a lot of similarities, but particularly in the realm of once a country goes to war and gets bogged down and loses soldiers, then the losing of soldiers becomes a justification for staying longer, to justify that loss, and then that justifies a longer stay, which in turn justifies a longer stay, and so forth. So I think in that sense the Vietnam comparisons are quite valid, and I think having lived through the Vietnam era, I could sort of conjure that and feel that that's the road we're headed on.
Well, you, as of course many other people, have pointed out that in war the first casualty is truth. But I often wonder, and I want to ask you, as someone who is, after all, the editor of Editor and Publisher, so you are really looking at the publishing industry, you're looking at editors, how is it that something that was so obvious to me, or anybody who had a shred of skepticism, for example, that Colin Powell was lying when he gave his speech to the UN in February 2003. How is it so obvious to us, but so invisible to journalists who are supposedly trained to be more skeptical? What put the blinders on?
Well, I think it's partly the echo chamber of Washington and the echo chamber of top-level journalists, where they're a little afraid to step out of line with their peers, to be seen as weak and national security type things, to be criticized even with people they're covering. They want to keep their their positions, they want to keep their standing in the pundit community, and so it's difficult for them to break away from that. It's much easier to go along with the conventional wisdom. And most of them do. And, even someone like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, who has the position and, background to be among someone who could have stood up to that, he fell for it himself. And, a lot of people kind of poke fun at him, as I do in the book. There's even a Wikipedia entry for something called the Friedman Unit, which a lot of people have some fun with. It's Friedman Unit is a six-month period of time. It's because Tom Friedman, every few months in the New York Times, would say we need to give the war six more months, and constantly threatening to withdraw his support for the war in another 6 months. So someone invented the term the Friedman Unit, which could be applied to anything, any six-month period that you might want to use. So people have some fun with that, but in reality, he was actually quite typical of most of the pundits. Yeah, I suppose some people could be depressed, but certainly enlightened by the fact that month after month passes and year after year passes, and you see the same things being said and the same editorials that refuse to call for a change in course, the same pundits and the same people saying, if things don't change soon, we need to pull out, and then things don't change, and then they say, we need to keep going. People who have argued otherwise have had a hard time breaking through. I think things are improved somewhat more now. I think there are more reporters who are skeptical. I think you do get at least some anti-war voices on TV, but that certainly wasn't true a few years ago.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Greg Mitchell. He's the editor of Editor and Publisher. We're talking about his book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. You know, I can remember during the run-up to war, actually reading an article in the New York Times. It might have been buried on the inside, but I think I remember it on the front page, where the CIA basically said that they had some doubts about the weapons of mass destruction and that there would be real consequences that to going to war in Iraq that bodes ill for the United States security. And then I began to feel as if, did I dream that?
No, the problem wasn't that there were no stories at all that raised some caution in the run-up to the war. It's that they were often buried. The more sensational stories were put on the front page, and TV was even more imbalanced. So it's not that every single story was making the case for war. It's just that too many of them were, and they were given undue prominence. And that's the problem. And reporters would kind of follow the spin of the administration, and then the administration figures would go on TV and say, and then quote the reporters. So sort of like the administration would leak to reporters. Reporters would publish it often on the front page, and then people like Vice President Cheney would go on TV and quote the New York Times. So it was a brilliant idea, but. It's as they say, garbage in, garbage out. So if it starts as garbage, it's still garbage at the other end of the line there.
So I think that's what happened with the whole mushroom cloud thing. Judith Miller published
right.
something, and then we hear Condi Rice going on talking about the what was that quote exactly?
It can become a mushroom cloud. It was the whole mushroom cloud imagery that was used over and over.
Right. Now, the press, on the other hand, is, it seems like even Democrats who are trying to get some traction on the war
mm-hmm.
have a real difficult time doing that. I think, for example, of John Edwards, who spoke about poverty but also spoke about the war. Certainly Obama has talked about it, but that's not what the press is picking up.
Right.
So what's happening?
Well, I mean, in the past year, and again, my book goes through last November, so it really traces, going back a year ago, the debate over the surge and then the fall off in coverage in the months that followed, and we certainly have seen in recent months the phenomenon of suddenly, reemergence of violence, great violence in Iraq. The U.S. death toll in April was the highest it had been in 7 months. And I could just imagine the readers or the public around the country sort of saying, whoa, what's going on here? I thought the war was over, or I thought we'd really turned the corner there. And because they were judging from the lack of media coverage. Now, the media spokesman said, in turn, we didn't think the public was that interested, and we have budget cuts, we have an election campaign going on, and these other issues to cover, and we just didn't think the public was that interested. So then the public was influenced by the lack of coverage. So again, you have a vicious circle here. So the bottom line was that the coverage declined a great deal, and so people were kind of caught by surprise by the recent surge in violence. So it's, we're really entering this period where the war has gone on so long, it's becoming almost background noise. And again, going back to the Vietnam era, whether people liked it or not, the at least demonstrations in the street kept the issue in front of people. And we don't see that now. We see a different kind of activism, which might be equally important, but it's quietly on websites and blogs and people organizing around candidates and raising anti-war evidence and statements on websites that have thousands or millions of readers. So it's not that there's no activism going on, but it's different. But it enables majority of people in the country to just go about their business thinking that nothing's really going on. No one's really upset about the war. And they don't see it that much in the media. They don't read these blogs or websites. And they're not upset about demonstrations because there are no demonstrations. So it allows people to go about their daily business without a draft.
And a lot of soldiers, a lot of veterans have pointed out, when they come back, they feel as if they're just in a different universe.
Right.
People aren't aware of it. And one thing this week, the House, the House of Representatives is holding hearings on veteran suicides, and this is something to which you devote a fair amount of ink in the book, even early on. I believe
right.
you mentioned it first on, you know, within the first 75 pages of the book. And it's an issue that the military is really under-reporting. I wonder if you could talk about this and also tell us about Alyssa. This was a very powerful story of a young woman that you write about in the book.
Right.
And I am speaking with Greg Mitchell about his book, So Wrong for So Long.
Well, I, for some reason, early on, I was very interested and moved by the large number of non-hostile casualties, as they're called in Iraq, that come from illness, from vehicle accidents, of which there are many, and friendly fire. And I found, you know, a number of suicides, and I was kind of surprised there were so many. And I just sort of kept at it, sort of no one else was particularly charting this, so this was an area I was thought I could really contribute by covering closely. So for years now, 5 years almost, I have written countless numbers of stories and columns about non-hostile deaths and suicides, both in Iraq and when veterans return home, which is a whole another story. This is an area that the military doesn't like to talk about. They don't really keep records that they make public. And the way I kind of could find out a lot was just by looking at local newspapers who sometimes would report what really happened that did not really come in the national press or come out of the Pentagon. So it's an area, the whole question of veterans in there, what's happened to them. We had a recent report of 300,000 veterans of Iraq and of Afghanistan suffering from some form of mental impairment, some sort of mental damage of some sort.
That's huge.
Yeah. And so I also talk about individual suicides. The case you were referring to was a young woman named Alyssa Peterson, who was a Mormon who joined the Army and became an interpreter and was sent to Iraq. And just a few weeks in, she was asked to take part in interrogations of prisoners and allegedly witnessed severe techniques, maybe what we might call torture. And she asked out. She said, I don't really want to do this. I don't want to take part in this. And she apparently was so troubled by her experience that just a few days after, she committed suicide. So I wrote about it. This was something that was covered by a local radio reporter out in New Mexico or Arizona, I think. And I sort of picked up on it, and it got quite a bit of attention when I wrote about it. You know, a woman sort of protesting the interrogation techniques and ends up dying.
Yeah, it was tragic. And another suicide that you profile was that of Ted Westhuizing,
right?
Who's the aide to General Petraeus. I wonder if you could say something about that, because he's, you know, he was not a lowly individual
right.
here.
Well, he was a colonel. He was a specialist in ethics. He taught at West Point. He was in his 40s, I think, early 40s, and quite a well-known individual. And he was in Iraq helping to supervise the training of Iraqis and the contractors, the early contractors early in the war, and was so troubled by corruption among the contractors, troubled by abuse of Iraqis. He, you know, made known in letters home or people he talked to, and he just became extremely troubled by this as an ethics person. And so he ended up shooting himself in the head. Some people have alleged it's murder. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that. But what's interesting as well is that in his suicide note, he mentioned General Petraeus and another general and seemed to suggest that they had a lot to answer for, you know, in this realm. It's remained vague. I've written about it extensively. It always gets a lot of attention because of the Petraeus connection, even though we can't yet say for sure what if anything Petraeus did wrong, but he was pointed at in the suicide note.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, though, about Iran. Is this deja vu all over again?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to say. You know, You know, I've wrote a column just in the last couple of weeks, and there's a column in the book about Michael Gordon of the New York Times.
Yeah.
He was one of the people, along with Judith Miller, who got stories wrong at the New York Times about weapons of mass destruction. But, you know, like nearly everyone in that boat, his career has not suffered. He got to write a best-selling book. Still at the Times, you know, the long roster of people, Bill Kristol and hundreds of others who are so wrong about the war and yet have seemingly benefited. The more wrong they are, the more they benefit. And so Gordon is still writing pieces periodically about raising alarms about Iran, and other news sources tend to disagree with him. So, you know, again, it's dangerous when these stories are taken seriously, and it's the same pattern in the run-up to the Iraq War. The difference is that there aren't as many people in that boat. There is more skepticism. We haven't reached a critical mass. I'm not sure whether we will or we would if the administration pressed its case as strongly as it did with Iraq. I would like to think that the media today would be more skeptical, but they haven't really been pressed that much on this issue. So.
And they don't seem to be all that skeptical. I haven't really seen much critique other than Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker.
Well, I think if you look carefully, you'd see. The most recently Michael Gordon piece, as I pointed out in the column, people at the AP, people at McClatchy, and other people poked holes or took an opposite. They sort of went to talked to the same people or went to the same press conference and came to radically different conclusions. So, like I said, I think there is more skepticism, but, you know, probably still not enough. But, you know, we just have to see what happens in the future.
And if it breaks down under pressure. Now, what about McCain? How come there is so little skepticism on the part of the press about John McCain?
He's always been a press favorite because he's very amiable with reporters, and in the past, at least, he did have his maverick side. I think that probably was true years ago, but a lot has happened in recent months and recent years where he's changed his position on almost everything. I think that with the Democratic race winding down, I would like to hope that the media has gone softer on McCain, partly because there's so much to write on the Democratic side, and they figure that, you know, there's still 6 months left before November, and there's plenty of time to bring out things about McCain. So I think maybe they went on hiatus a bit with McCain, but there's plenty of time to make up for that.
So, Greg Mitchell, are you going to be writing about McCain? Are you going to be holding the press's feet to the fire at editor and publisher?
Well, I'm sure. You know, I have this platform online in my column. I also blog for some other places, and so I'm sure I'll be writing about the campaign. I do mainly write about issues related to the war, but since that intersects so much with the campaign, I'm sure there'll be some overlap there as well. So,
well, thanks for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Your book is So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. Greg Mitchell. He's editor of the trade magazine, editor and publisher. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we talk with acclaimed novelist Louise Erdrich about her newest work of fiction, The Plague of Doves. I'm a great fan of Erdrich's, and I think this one is her best novel. To find out more about Writer's Voice or listen to past shows, go to writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.